Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to ensure your skeletal health. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. In addition to the Bone Health Protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links from my Supplement Starter Kit, Heart Health Protocol, and much more. These new protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the Intelligent Medicine lifestyle, and for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about medical mistakes. And there's a new documentary that's about to hit the scene. It's called To Err Is Human. And it's a blockbuster expose of the prevalence of medical errors. Medical mistakes contribute to as many as 440,000 preventable deaths every year, making it the number three leading cause of death in the United States. With us, the producer, director, writer of the movie, who is Mike Eisenberg. And, Mike, you know, just share this one with you. Just, you know, this is one of the headlines that rolls out, out of some of the medical periodicals that I screen on a daily basis. I pulled this one up today. Post-colonoscopy endoscopy infection rates higher than thought. They say, quote, the observed post-endoscopic infection rates at some ambulatory surgical centers are over 100 times higher than their expected rates that account for patient severity and procedure complexity. And so there seems to be, what they're saying is there's great variation from facility to facility. Is that part of the problem? I mean, you got to pick the right hospital, you got to pick the right doctor. Is there lack of uniformity among for safety procedures?
Well, this is kind of the big problem in medicine when it comes to quality, is that it's not like aviation, where there is a Federal Aviation Administration, or I got it wrong, that is in charge of investigating errors and mistakes and making sure that across the board everybody follows the same rules. That's not how it works in medicine. There are some regulations, but generally speaking, these are even the nonprofit, but they're, you know, these are profitable ventures in which they are trying to serve a community and be the best and the most desired version of that community's healthcare provider, right? So everybody's out for themselves in many cases, and that is not always in the best interest of quality or of the patient. Now, that's not to say that they aren't all trying to deliver perfect, safe care. It just means that they're all going to be doing it a little differently. Now, our film touches upon ways that patients can figure out the quality of their provider, because in many cases, they're only going to see what the hospital wants them to see, you know, whatever rating they're proud of. But there are rating systems that take all of those different factors, including the rates of infections, and puts them together in a grading system that is comprehensive. It's called Hospital Safety Grade, and, you know, we kind of touch on that in the film as an emphasis on the fact that reporting is really important to improving care. And when you really look at it, it's not that a hospital that reports no errors is the safest place. In fact, it's usually the opposite, because if they are not reporting mistakes, they are probably lying. So, and at the same time, it's not like, okay, well, the one that has the most mistakes is the safest because they are acknowledging them.
Maybe that's like a very, you know, place where they do the most complex procedures, that take the, you know, right, take on the most challenging patients, and, you know, their results may not be as good as the place, right, where they send a lot of patients to bigger hospitals.
I suppose we could have named the film "Results May Vary." I mean, exactly. It's a complex industry. Everybody knows that. The results are different from patient to patient. You can probably perform the same procedure the same exact way on person A and person B, and you will have a different result in some way. And that's not to say that we can't find transparency in these errors. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, what you saw was transparency, not bad medicine. Mm-hmm. What you saw in that report was hospitals providing data to be transparent about their quality. And I'm sure they want to be better. I'm sure they want to have lower rates of incidents, but they won't get that unless they're held accountable. Mm-hmm. And being held accountable does not always mean punishment. No. Actually, sometimes it means the opposite.
Incentives. Well, so, yeah, that brings us to the subject of malpractice, you know, which is the bane of every doctor's existence. You know, we literally live in fear of that record request or that subpoena that tells us that something has gone awry in our patient's care. And it's a punitive system. I literally know colleagues who've committed suicide after being faced with malpractice suits. It's quite tragic because we as physicians, you know, we're taught to feel that we are, you know, we're great 4.0 students. You know, we you know, get great scores on MCATs. We're very perfectionistic individuals. And then somebody comes to harm or even dies on our watch, and it's really life-shattering for us if we have a conscience. And so the system of malpractice does bring some degree of accountability, but it doesn't seem to be working that well to curb this massive epidemic of medical errors.
Well, no, because then you see the hospitals get lawyered up before they even need a lawyer, and then it just becomes a muscle show. It's who has more money to spare, and then you can just sort of push the patients away from finding this transparency and these solutions so these errors don't happen to other people. But in most cases, look, I'll give you a good example. Okay, so at Yale, we did a screening, and the CEO of the hospital, Yale New Haven Hospital, was part of our panel discussion after the screening. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions was related to this, litigation and medical malpractice and all that. And her answer was very compelling to me. It was something along the lines, and I'll paraphrase, of if something goes wrong, the patients should have the right to sue. If something goes not according to plan, they have the right to sue us. But the goal should not be to prevent lawsuits. The goal should be to provide timely and quality care. Lawsuits make a mess out of the whole thing. I think they provide the patient with what they probably deserve financially for a crisis that happened. But if the result is just money, then nothing actually gets better. Yeah. And so what I hope to see in this part of medicine, this malpractice part, is not a war of two sides. Can we win this case? Can we prove somehow, some way that this is not our fault? Or can we get as much money out of these people as possible and be rich for the rest of our lives? Like, that's not always the reasoning behind lawsuits, but the purpose should be transparency, and the purpose should be preventing these errors from happening again. Whatever it is, whether it's leaving a scalpel in someone's chest or whether it's, you know, a fax not going through. Mm-hmm. And there are other fish to fry in medicine. Access to care, access to medical records. People's attention is frayed. And that means that the quality issue is not going to be on the forefront for a while. And for us, when we start to address the issues and we start to showcase what can be done and how it can be improved, the reactions we've been getting are not what we thought, which was what you said. I don't want to get sued, so I don't even want to look at this issue. I'm going to do the best I can and try not to get sued. Mm-hmm.
An unfortunate consequence of this is over-treatment, over-testing, which is to the detriment of many patients because it's, well, you know, this patient has high cholesterol and, you know, even if it's a little high, I better put them on a statin drug because the guidelines state that they should be on the statin drug when perhaps, you know, lifestyle, diet, that form of intervention should be prioritized. But, you know, it's going to look really bad on the chart when the patient has a heart attack and the doctor failed to put them on a statin. That's called defensive medicine. It drives up the cost of medicine. It causes a lot of unnecessary side effects, misery, et cetera.
Well, this is probably how we got to the opioid crisis that we have today, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the opioid crisis is a patient safety crisis as well. It comes from many different factors, but I think one of the main things is this fear of under-medicating and under-treating, and so giving people the strongest possible medicine that they can have, and assuming that they'll be responsible with it. I think the assumption needs to be not that doctors know all, but that doctors should be working with the patients to find the best way to treat every illness, and instead of looking back at their years and years of education to think of all the possible things, look at the patient. Talk to the patient. Look at the person sitting across from you in the room and talk to them. Use those 15 minutes that you have to get the most information possible out of the patient to figure out what's best for them. And hopefully by doing that, the patient will give more information to you, because I don't think patients know everything they think they know, or at least they don't, or maybe, yeah, they don't know everything they think they know. And they also don't know what they know. They need that to be coaxed out of them by the doctors who have the experience. And working together as a team, once again, is such an important part of this process to make sure we don't waste money, we don't waste resources, and we get the right care at the right time.
Now, technology surely plays a role in many industries. You know, flight simulators are very sophisticated before you even get behind the joystick of a plane. You know, you're going to spend a lot of time in a simulator. I think, based on my experience, that's certainly not what happens in medicine. More and more so, it is happening through developments in technology. Also, technology offers an opportunity to do checks and cross-checks, and, you know, various forms of alerts can be built into command chains. How is that being harnessed to help avoid errors?
Well, I love the example we have in the film of this surgeon in Toronto who is implementing the black box technology from aviation into medicine, into the surgical theater. And not cameras in the surgical theater to catch an egregious error, right? To catch you in the act. Mm-hmm. But technology that takes data and puts it together. So they have these
artificial intelligence and so on. I mean, we're really making advances in our ability to understand and present data.
Right. And what they're doing over there in Toronto at St. Michael's is, you know, monitoring all these things and creating a timeline. They see how many times the door is open, the volume of audio levels in the room, how many times each thing it happens in the room, everything. And there's cameras, there's audio devices, but there's also a person at a computer typing in all these little moments. And they look at it in a timeline, and they can actually see when, if an error did occur, or the quality of that surgery dips, they can see why. What happened? What mm-hmm. were the trends? Mm-hmm. They put that information together, and they disseminate that information out to all the other surgeons and to other hospitals so that they can improve without having to actually make the mistakes in the first place. And that's a tremendous step forward. I mean, that is all of the positive steps in one nutshell. Technology, interoperability, communication. We need to learn how to use data appropriately before we start coming up with fancy robots to do the work for us.
Indeed. I found one segment of the movie fascinating because there is something called the Room of Horrors, which is a training exercise for doctors and nurses and health personnel in training. Can you describe that?
Oh, yeah. I love that, too. So right in our backyard, we're from Chicago here, at the University of Chicago, they have this training process in which I think it's third or fourth year physicians, I don't actually remember what year they are, but they're advanced in their medical practice. And before they actually go out into the field, these instructors, they put 10 plus errors in a small clinical room. And there is a monitor, a person with a checklist of the things that these people need to find. And there's usually two of them, so they work as in tandem. They walk in the room and they have a time limit, 10 minutes, I think, to identify all these errors in the room. And if they do it, they have a discussion afterwards and they try and figure out how they can prevent those things from actually affecting a patient. And in the end, what's great about it is they are learning in real time how to walk into a room and identify hazards that shouldn't be there. And we're not talking about too much. We're not talking about the obvious things. We're talking about, you know, some pretty minuscule things that have to do specifically with the patient. One thing that I think's pretty cool is that we're actually working with University of Chicago now to develop a web game, a game version of this Room of Horrors that we'll hopefully be able to add to our website before the film releases in the fall. And we're going to kind of we're going to make it a little bit more general public friendly. It's not going to be super medical, but I hope it will still have like some ability
sort of like
to
be a mystery
used.
Tour, you know, like a whodunit,
like
kind of like a whodunit, you know, in a video form.
Yeah, you know, the game Highlights would be a good example, or the magazine. So our hope is that, you know, through this tool, people will learn how themselves to identify things in a hospital room when they walk in, either themselves as a patient or as an advocate. And one of those cool things will be, okay, maybe you got all 10 things right, but you didn't wash your hands first. So you, at the end of that game, will be told, well, guess what? You got all the things right. You saw them. But if you don't walk into the room and wash your hands first, you run the risk of this. So I think we'll be informing people in ways beyond the 77-minute runtime of the film and taking on as many methods as possible of changing the culture of safety on both sides of the coin.
Another element of this, I mean, this is all sometimes referred to as iatrogenic disease. In other words, medicine-caused disease. And an element of this is that many drugs, many surgical procedures are not really ready for prime time. They're misguided. They, you know, drugs that get ultimately rescinded, surgical procedures that we think better of, very aggressive forms of chemotherapy with, you know, perhaps over the top, and then now are thought to be obsolete. I mean, is that an element of patient hazard?
I don't know. I would assume so. I mean, I think everybody is on board with the idea that you have to take risks to make advancements in medicine. And in many cases, those risks cannot be only taken on, you know, testing animals or something like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you really do have to put things in the hands of clinicians and real patients and see if they work.
It's a risk-benefit equation. In other words, if the potential gain is important, then undergoing some degree of, and there's no medical procedure that is without some degree of risk.
Right. I mean, look at the guy who invented liver transplants. I forget his name right now, but there was a documentary that we saw recently. It's coming out this year as well about him. Stanzi, something like that, maybe, where, you know, he was lauded for years for trying to find a way to transplant organs from one body to another person's body. And a lot of things happened along the way that were tragic and fatal. But what we have now is an incredible medical miracle of being able to save lives by taking body parts from one person and putting them in another. And never would have figured out how to do that had they not actually tried it on people. And so while I don't know much about this part of medicine, my assumption is that, yes, you do have to crack a few eggs to make an omelet, but we have to make sure we're doing it carefully. If you're just throwing eggs against the wall and hoping that the stuff falls in the pot, that's a different story. If you're carefully trying to make sure that you do these things in an effective and safe way, and you do them without risking people's lives egregiously, that's good medicine. There are other ways of doing it that are not so good.
Where do you see this going in, say, a decade or perhaps a couple of decades, or maybe, you know, mid 21st century? You think we'll crack this problem?
I do. I don't think you can ever get to zero errors, but I do think you can get to zero harm. Those are two very different things. And if you look at the field of patient safety, it's really only been around for 15 or 20 years. I mean, you know, people have been trying to do things better for decades, but identifying harms that happen is relatively new in medicine. And I don't know how you calculate success, whether it's being able to identify the number of potentially, 250,000, 440,000 being less, but we're seeing success already. You know, catheter infection rates are dropping like crazy because they've found ways to do that safer. But in 15, 20 years, my hope is that this is a natural part of education in medicine, that every doctor, nurse, hospice worker, at some point before they actually start working with patients, with real people, they understand the hazards that come with that responsibility. And more importantly, they don't get trained to be scared to be open and transparent with patients.
Right.
That's a huge, huge step for medicine, is to get past that barrier of don't get sued, and instead figure out how, if you missed something on an x-ray or something, or an MRI or something, and it's 6 months later, talk to the patient.
Yeah.
Let's be open. Let's admit mistakes and nip them in the bud before they exacerbate and become life-threatening.
Right. That is a big issue, because admitting errors is tough, both because doctors are perfectionistic, but also because admitting errors has liability implications. And often I think doctors draw away from patients who they may have made mistakes on. And in that conversation, it's very tough to say, hey, Joe, I'm really sorry, but 3 months ago we should have recognized that that little bump in your colon was an early cancer. We might have gotten a better jump on your colon cancer that now seems to have progressed. That's a really tough conversation to have. How do you get past that?
Well, that's definitely something that, if, when you watch the film, you'll see it happening.
It's addressed in the film. Yeah.
Yeah, they're actually doing that training. This is why when you say 15 to 20 years, I think that's a much more reasonable expectation. It's unfortunate, but when you think about it, this is a generational thing. The next generation of people providing medicine are going to be thinking about safety differently than the last generation. That's not to say that there aren't 75-year-old physicians who've been doing it for 50 years that aren't super safe and always thinking about it. But, I think this is a new idea, a new way of thinking about medicine. And especially as technology advances and we become more open about medicine, and HIPAA laws could change, the way people can access their care might change, we have to make it possible for clinicians to adapt with it. And one of those things is transparency, not creating an iron curtain between patients and doctors. My experience with my vet for my dog is much more transparent and open than it is with my actual doctors.
It is amazing. I mean, because it's going to require a real culture change in medicine. Hopefully your documentary will be transformative. It certainly is going to increase public awareness, and I hope that a lot of medical professionals get to view it. It's going to hit the screens for general public consumption this fall, but give us the heads up on how people can find out more about it.
Well, so we are pretty active on social media. We use Twitter quite a bit. The Twitter handle is toairishumandoc, and I think that's a great way for us to connect with people and to see what's going on in healthcare today, because right now the Institute for Healthcare Improvement has a patient safety congress going on that we couldn't be at. But when you are on Twitter and you look at the hashtag, you actually can learn a lot by just, seeing what's being talked about. Anyway, toairishumandoc on Twitter. We're also on Facebook. And our website will be constantly updated with resources for clinicians, patients, hopefully that web game that we talked about, and other screening updates along the way. So those are the three best ways to connect with us. And then in the fall, hopefully, we will be streaming, and people will be able to watch it and talk about it openly instead of just these sort of one-off screenings, which are super valuable, but a little bit condensed in terms of their ability to impact the overall scope of healthcare.
Okay. Well, Mike Eisenberg, congratulations for tackling an issue of great importance. Mike is of TallTaleProductions.com. It's a production company that produces documentaries and other film works. And once again, the website is toairishumanfilm.com. Toairishumanfilm.com. Hey, thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.